So Vince, the one thing I was kind of hearing a few times, I'm really curious about your thoughts, is this issue of EGFR TKI maintenance. And I think I heard Chandra say that he thinks about it mainly with people with mutations, although I imagine you're thinking about upfront therapy if you've seen the patient to start with. But second opinion, the patient's already got chemo. Do you agree, Vince, that mainly you're going to think about erlotinib if they have a mutation or also in non-mutants?
Well, certainly if I saw someone walk in the door that had chemotherapy first and then was thereafter found to have an EGFR mutation, I would strongly consider the use of erlotinib. On the other hand, if they were feeling well or doing well with initial chemotherapy and were in a maintenance phase with that, I might well continue them on that and know that I had Mariano Rivera, so to speak, in the bullpen by lung cancer standards. Now, for the other group of patients, I really think that one thing that's interesting in the maintenance field is if one looks at Saturn, and this was data presented at a European meeting recently, and breaks down the benefit people attain from maintenance who had a partial response to chemo versus those who had stable disease, the benefit was much greater in survival and stable disease. And I went back and looked at Chandra's paper, and the stable disease patients had an even greater benefit from pemetrexed maintenance than those who had partial response. To me, that tells me that's a group of patients who may be sitting on a powder keg of aggressive cancer, and you're really uniformly making sure they get a whack at second-line therapy rather than allowing many of them to fall off the map. And so I'm intrigued by that. Actually, we're going back and looking at that in Atlas.
I think that's a subset analysis again, and I don't think we need to pay a lot of emphasis towards the subset. But you're right that stable patients are the ones who probably need that maintenance therapy.
So does that mean, Vince, if they are responding, you're less likely to think about maintenance?
Yeah, I think so, because you have something that's proven to work, and I understand that that's maybe a little bit difficult to reconcile with some of the data, but I think it's also supported by some aspects of the data.
Mark, is there any evidence that maintenance is superior to second-line treatment? I thought about the conversation you and I had last summer after Chandra presented the data, trying to tease really this question out. Is this maintenance or is it early second line? And could you just observe the patient and treat second line?
The danger with observing patients is that they might have a disease-related complication that precludes getting second line therapy. And all the data that Chandra presented, there was a major imbalance between the exposure to effective therapies on the so-called maintenance arms versus the placebo arms of these trials. And we have to reconcile that. I think actually the most telling point to me about this immediate versus delayed thing came from the analysis of the FIDEOS trial. And what FIDEOS showed is that if you got docetaxel early versus late, as long as you got it, the survival was not different, suggesting that it's exposure, not necessarily timing. The risk of delaying the timing is that about a third of patients will never get it because they drop out typically because of a rapid decline in performance status because of some disease-related complication. So it brings up the issue of treatment breaks. I still think treatment breaks are very reasonable in this incurable disease setting. And so I haven't totally bought into the maintenance concept in many people. I think what the maintenance trials are telling us is that second-line therapy works. But we've known that for 10 years. It's our job as oncologists to get it into patients, and that really causes us to rethink our surveillance strategies in this population.
So, Tom, agree, disagree, or in between?
Exactly, I agree. I think that when the FIDEOS data first came out and the maintenance data first came out after that from Chandra, many people felt, well, listen, I'm a good enough doc that I don't need to do maintenance because I can tell who's going to fall off the cliff, as Vince said. And I really think that we're not good enough docs. I participated in two of those studies, and I think I'm pretty good. And I wasn't pretty good because it showed that the people who didn't get maintenance didn't do as well. And I think that the group that's most likely to fall off the cliff are the stable disease patients. Now, I do disagree a little bit in that the patients who have the great response are the ones you really want to push the most to get the best outcomes. So I think you have a rationale for treating both those groups of patients. I agree that the stable disease patients are ones that we should not give up on.
So, Charles, what's your take on this? And what do you think is going on biologically? Is it just the fact that we're, quote, getting in second-line therapy, or do you buy into that?
No, I think the whole issue is second-line therapy is efficient, and you need to deliver it. And I think for your life in an incurable disease, having treatment breaks is key. At least in France, it's very important for your survival. So I don't know if people here want to be under pressure of a therapy forever, but I disagree with that.
Chandra, maybe you can go back through it a little bit more and also address the patient who gets PEM as part of first-line therapy. Do you use PEM maintenance? And then again, in this trial, looking at Bev-PEM, but what about outside of this protocol setting? How do you approach it, and what's the rationale for this study?
So this trial is actually the next trial to ECOG 4599. The standard for ECOG is carboplatin, paclitaxel, and bevacizumab as the standard of care, followed by bevacizumab, which was ECOG 4599. That is the control arm of the study. And the pemetrexed alone is based on the approval of pemetrexed based on the pemetrexed maintenance trial that we have published. And the combination would be the question that raised by the audience, do both the agents in combination actually give you a better overall outcome? And actually, as Tom was saying, that it is very difficult to predict those third of patients who really fall off the wagon and don't make it to second line. And these are the patients who are actually benefiting. So I agree that the responsive patients are also benefiting, but these stable patients are the ones who really need this maintenance therapy. And we won't be able to prove, say, now as Mark was pointing out, that they are imbalanced, because what will we say from this trial that which patients received subsequent therapy with the same agent? Because now there is a second variable, because on one arm of the trial there are two drugs. So it will not be possible to answer the question which Tom is asking, that we should give everybody the drug which is given on the maintenance arm. So as Tom pointed out, in the FIDES trial, docetaxel was supposed to be the agent to be given in the maintenance setting at progression as true second line, but a third of the patients did not get it. And if those patients are included, the survival on the maintenance docetaxel study, maintenance docetaxel arm, is 3 months greater than the other arm. So that's the study. Now, to complement the study, as Neil is pointing out, can we give a carboplatin-based regimen which is different than carboplatin paclitaxel? And that's the point break study. That's carboplatin pemetrexed with bevacizumab, and then they are followed with pemetrexed and bevacizumab. As I said, there are two variables, but I think that it will at least answer the question whether it is better than the control arm or the investigational arm of 4599, which is the control arm of the study also.
Vince, what about the question that Chandra brought up about continuation in Bev and people who've gotten chemo-Bev? Again, this is a question that comes up in breast cancer, comes up in colorectal cancer. I think the trials continued the Bev alone until progression, correct?
I mean, the trial, ECOG 4599, continued Bev, be it right or wrong, until progression.
And now, do you do that in your practice?
In general, yes.
And do you agree with Chandra that we maybe don't really know whether that helps or not, and any intuition about whether it helps or not?
I agree with Chandra. We don't know the answer to that, but again, we can't parse subgroups or change the way that the pivotal trial was done. I do think there is some interest in answering a slightly different question, as I think you were getting into with Herceptin, is what is the value of continuing bevacizumab as a second-line agent is added in when an individual progresses on the bevacizumab alone?
I actually wasn't thinking about that, but it is a great question. Of course, in trastuzumab, we never had any data on this. Everybody was doing it for years and years. We thought, well, maybe it's not even helping, and then we started to see randomized data. There are two trials now that show that it actually helps. We don't really have that with Bev, I guess, at this point.
I'd be curious what the panelists' intuition is. Unfortunately, mine is that it probably does help to continue, although many times I do stop to be rigorous. And many of us have seen, you know, there's a bunch of preclinical papers that there'll be explosions after you stop.
I think that we're going to have this year at ASCO a very interesting data towards that question in ovarian, because there is the experimental arm with Bev and there's an experimental arm with Bev which is carried on. And I think you need to stay tuned and see that oral presentation.
And Tom, Vince used the word, unfortunately, I'm not sure if you were thinking about cost, and we do have a number of questions here, because when you think about Bev, in a lot of the biologics, that's kind of more of the issue than the toxicity or quality of life issues. What are your thoughts about how do you think this is going to play out, Tom, in the future in terms of continuation of Bev long term, maybe in select patients?
I know why you're asking, because we don't have that data. And I think what will drive the data is increasingly using biomarkers to define which subsets of people are more likely to benefit. I don't think anyone regrets giving people Gleevec for CML, regardless of the cost, or giving it for GIST, regardless of the cost, or Sutent for GIST. But the key thing in many of these settings is when you see a 1 or 2 month benefit with cetuximab or 2 months with Bev, have, I think you're wondering which patients are going to benefit. And if you're an insurance company who's going to drive this, they're going to increasingly want to know that. Until we have that data, I think you have to throw your hands up and try to do the best you can for the patient and let the chips fall where they may with costs. But increasingly, the drive for biomarkers will be driven by that.
Do you have any sense, Tom, in terms of duration of bevacizumab and benefit? Again, one of the intriguing things about Norm Walmuck's presentation was that these patients seem to do better, you know, 40% fewer recurrences while they were in Bev, and then it just started dropping right down. What do you think about that?
I think that's an intriguing question. Hopefully that will be something which we'll get from the adjuvant trial. There's some instincts about that insight we'll get from the adjuvant trial.